Today is Friday, February 5th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, internet shutdowns threaten free world.
Internet cuts have been tracked in Uganda, Ethiopia's Tigray region, Belarus, and India, among other countries, around times of contested elections, protests, or civil unrest.
Also ahead, U.S. President Joe Biden wants to end U.S. support for the war in Yemen.
This war has to end.
Plus, we look at the threat of violent extremism in the United States. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Myanmar, where hundreds of students and teachers have taken to the streets to demand the military hand power back to elected politicians. This is as resistance to a coup earlier this week swelled with demonstrations in several parts of the country. In the largest protests since the takeover, protesters at two universities today flashed a three-fingered salute, a sign of resistance that they adopted from anti-government protesters in neighboring Thailand. But as part of its power grab, Myanmar's military has cut access to the internet. It's a tactic seen globally at times of tension and unrest, as VOA's Isha Sarai reports.
As the military seized power in Myanmar this week, it intermittently cut off access to the internet. That affected the ability of citizens to communicate, get information about the coup, and, of course, the ability of journalists to cover the crisis. Nguyen Yen, who writes for a Burmese news organization across the border in Thailand, said she'd had trouble reaching her colleagues.
On Monday, my colleagues were out of reach for 3 or 4 hours when the military totally shut down not only internet, mobile, services. So they didn't come online. And on the morning, we were having very early newsroom meetings and how we are going to report. And then 7 a.m., they all gone.
Internet shutdowns in Myanmar are not new, notes Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression.
In the context of Myanmar, internet shutdowns have been happening over the past years. I mean, there are a number of townships in the Rakhine and Chin states that have not had internet connection or have been throttled, reduced internet connection for a long time.
Internet cuts have been tracked in Uganda, Ethiopia's Tigray region, Belarus, and India, among other countries, around times of contested elections, protests, or civil unrest. In Kashmir, access to fast internet has been blocked since India revoked the contested region's special status in 2019. India says the blocks are needed to fight extremism and false news, according to Syed Sheriar, an independent journalist based in Srinagar.
Whenever, even right now, if there is a gun battle in South Kashmir, the government will suspend internet of that area.
Internet blackouts, slowing the internet, and blocking websites make access to information more difficult, says Felicia Antonio of the Keep It On campaign.
And that is what internet shutdowns do. When you find yourself in a crisis and you don't have access to information, you're not able to reach your family and friends, you are left in a state of confusion.
So much so that the UN has declared internet blackouts unlawful.
They're a very blunt instrument that is being used to cut off people's right to access information.
The state of the internet in Myanmar has changed regularly over the past week, but journalists and activists say they remain determined to communicate. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
In India, media coverage and social media chatter about the tens of thousands of protesting farmers at the edges of the capital, New Delhi, have prompted a furious reaction from Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government. The farmers have been protesting for months against Modi's government's plan to deregulate the agricultural industry. Even so, the protests are spreading, with thousands more farmers rallying today in the politically important state of Uttar Pradesh. But critics say the government has used the massive demonstrations to escalate a crackdown on the media and free speech, by detaining journalists and freezing Twitter accounts. While some of the accounts have been restored this week, 9 journalists and an opposition lawmaker are facing sedition charges for their reporting on the protests. Modi's supporters have also gone after people speaking out against the farm laws. Yesterday, pro-government activists in India burned posters of climate activist Greta Thunberg and singer Rihanna. Both of them had commented in support of the farmers in the country. Emma McCarthy of Reuters reports.
Activists from India's United Hindu Front burned posters of climate activist Greta Thunberg and singer Rihanna on Thursday after the two commented on social media in support of the ongoing farmer protests there. Both Thunberg and Rihanna tweeted in support of farmers who have been protesting since late 2020 over new agriculture laws which the protesters say benefit private buyers at the expense of growers. U.S. lawyer and activist Mina Harris, the niece of Vice President Kamala Harris, also spoke out on Twitter saying, "We all should be outraged by India's internet shutdowns and paramilitary violence against farmer protesters." Pictures of her and her aunt were also destroyed, with the United Hindu Front calling the tweets interference by foreign powers in internal matters of India and provocation of Indians. The US Embassy in New Delhi urged India's government on Thursday to resume talks with farmers. India's foreign ministry said it had taken note of the embassy's comments and underlined ongoing efforts between Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government and farmers' groups to resolve the situation.
That was Emma McCarthy of Reuters. In the U.S., the Biden administration announced in January that the U.S. would join COVAX, the global efforts by the World Health Organization and other groups to ensure that lower-income countries have access to coronavirus vaccines. But as VOA's senior White House correspondent Patsy Whitakaswara reports, the U.S. has not pledged any more funding beyond the $4 billion approved by Congress in December.
The Global Coronavirus Vaccine Initiative, COVAX, aims to deliver 2 billion doses to people in 92 lower-income countries by the end of 2021. Anne Lindstrom heads the vaccination program at the World Health Organization.
It is a strategy to rapidly contain the pandemic, save lives, protect healthcare systems, and restore the global economies based on human rights principles of equity and epidemiologic evidence from the pandemic.
The U.S. joined COVAX on January 21st, the same day it rejoined the World Health Organization. President Joe Biden reiterated the message Thursday.
We've also re-engaged with the World Health Organization. That way we can build better global preparedness to counter COVID-19, as well as detect and prevent future pandemics, because there will be more.
That's a departure from his predecessor, who withdrew from WHO in July 2020.
Because they have failed to make the requested and greatly needed reforms.
But Biden's administration has provided little detail on the scope and scale of U.S. commitment beyond the $4 billion funding approved by Congress in December for Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, one of the co-leaders of COVAX. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
We have reiterated our commitment to COVAX. I don't have any additional funding, though, to announce today.
To meet its target, COVAX says it needs $4.9 billion in addition to the $2.1 billion it has already raised. It's also dealing with vaccine scarcity as wealthy countries build up stockpiles for their own populations. 40 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine have been promised to COVAX, but only 1.2 million are available in the first quarter of 2021. Seth Berkley is CEO of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance.
We encourage every manufacturer to make the largest number of doses they can available early so that we can make sure that we get equitable distribution going.
In addition to the Pfizer-BioNTech shots, COVAX will distribute 336 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine in the first half of this year. Dr. Bruce Gellin is the president of Global Immunization at the Sabin Vaccine Institute.
There was vaccines that they were clearly available, that they had some control over, and started to make those allocation projections primarily so countries could begin to plan. They're not finished, and so we're going to see much more from COVAX about more vaccines going to those countries with the opportunity to reach initially 3% of the population, but with a larger goal of 20%.
The hope is that with this initial forecast from COVAX, countries can begin their immunization strategies, including storage, distribution, and how to address vaccine hesitancy. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
President Biden also visited the State Department yesterday and outlined his vision for U.S. foreign policy, ordering an end to U.S. support for offensive military operations in Yemen, as well as an overall shift toward diplomacy. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Biden reversed course from former President Donald Trump's support for the Saudi-led military intervention in Yemen's civil war.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
Biden is creating the post of a U.S. envoy to Yemen and has named career diplomat Tim Linderking to the job. One expert said this marks a significant shift. Brian Katulis of the Center for American Progress.
Having a U.S. diplomat there, I think, sends a powerful signal that the U.S. is truly committed to conflict resolution and wants to see something happen.
Biden had another major announcement on accepting refugees from deadly conflicts like the one in Yemen.
I'm approving an executive order to begin the hard work of restoring our refugee admissions program to help meet the unprecedented global need.
Biden condemned the coup in Myanmar and called on the military to relinquish power, release civilian leaders, and restore internet service and communications. The president also announced a global review of all U.S. forces around the world and froze Trump's planned troop withdrawals from Germany. Katulis said the move reassures Germany and other close U.S. allies in Europe after what he says were unpredictable actions by Trump.
I think what this move does is sort of send U.S. foreign policy back to the norms where the U.S. is working closely with allies, especially Democratic allies.
Biden told State Department employees he values their expertise and will never target them or politicize their work. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
This is VOA. South Africa's health minister, Zweli Mkhize, said in Parliament today that the country had secured enough COVID-19 vaccines for at least 26 million people. South Africa aims to vaccinate 40 million people, or two-thirds of its population, to reach herd immunity. South Africa has recorded the most coronavirus infections and deaths in Africa and received its first shots of the AstraZeneca vaccine from India this week. A health ministry presentation said the government also signed a term sheet for 9 million doses of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine at $10 a dose. The presentation added that Moderna had offered the country 200,000 doses of its COVID-19 vaccine at $30 to $42 a dose in the second quarter, with more doses available in the third quarter. And in Japan, Tokyo's governor said today that the Olympic Games face a, quote, major issue, end quote, after the head of the Tokyo Olympics organizing committee made sexist remarks. 83-year-old former Prime Minister Yoshiro Mori set off a storm on social media, both at home and abroad this week, by saying in a meeting with the Japan Olympic Committee that women talk too much. He later retracted the comments and apologized, but refused to resign. That hasn't quelled outrage. Reuters reports that one female staffer of the Tokyo Organizing Committee said, quote, "This is the reality of what women in Japan are facing every day. Old guys with outdated mindsets continue to hold power and are making decisions," end quote. The Japanese public is already wary of the government's attempts to hold the Olympics during the pandemic. Nearly 80% of the public opposes holding the Games in July, according to the most recent poll. Listening to International Edition on The Voice of America, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. In the U.S., Democrats and Republicans are laying out their strategies ahead of Tuesday's start to the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. VOA's Steve Reddish explains what is behind the arguments for both sides.
Last month's attack on the U.S. Capitol prompted the House of Representatives, led by Democrats with the support of 10 Republicans, to impeach then-President Donald Trump for an unprecedented second time. House Democrats, who will prosecute the case before the jury of U.S. senators, say Trump incited the attack that killed five people, including a Capitol police officer. And they will use Trump's own words and video from the riot to try to sway the jury.
In terms of the strategy that the Democratic Party is using, which is to say, you know, this guy is a threat. He is still a threat. He is currently a threat. He was a threat. The insurrection is a result of his violent incitement rhetoric.
Jennifer Murcia is a professor of American political rhetoric at Texas A&M University.
So if they can activate people's memories of the event and they can, sort of remind them of the fear that they felt and reactivate that fight or flight response, they might find that they're able to persuade, you know, even beyond the partisanship.
With the 100-member Senate evenly split, Democrats need 17 Republicans to join them to vote to convict former President Trump. But the word former is at the crux of the Republican strategy. Republican Senator Rand Paul.
If the accused is no longer president, where is the constitutional power to impeach him? Private citizens don't get impeached. Impeachment is for removal from office. And the accused here has already left office.
Republicans lost a vote on the trial's constitutionality, but the 55-45 vote leaves Democrats well shy of the 67 votes needed. Again, Jennifer Murcia.
I think they really are just trying to keep this at the level of procedure. This is simply a procedural question at this point. We're not going to relitigate, you know, this question of violence and the insurrection and whether Trump's at fault or not.
And Murcia says social media's silencing of Trump may work against the Democrats' strategy.
They really will be trying to use fear appeal, you know, and make the argument about safety and that he's a clear and present danger. And I think the fact that he's been deplatformed really actually hurts that argument, because if he was still online, he would still be making all of those same arguments. He would still be that clear and present danger.
House Democrats formally requested that Trump testify at his impeachment trial set to start Tuesday. When asked if he will testify, lawyers for the former president said no. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, in the U.S. Congress, a fiercely divided House of Representatives tossed far-right Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene off both her committees Thursday evening. Taylor Greene is a close ally of former President Donald Trump and had made or supported comments advocating for violence against Democrats. She also supported the anti-Semitic QAnon conspiracy theory and supported claims that the 9/11 Al-Qaeda attacks and the Sandy Hook school shooting were not real. After Republicans refused to remove her from her committees for such comments, Democrats called a floor vote. Before the vote, Taylor Greene did not explicitly apologize for her remarks, instead claiming she no longer believes what she said. All 219 Democrat lawmakers plus 11 Republicans voted to oust her from the Education and Labor and Budget Committees. 119 Republicans voted to support her. Also in the House of Representatives Thursday, U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez led her fellow Democratic lawmakers in giving emotional testimonies recounting their traumatic experiences of the deadly siege of the Capitol on January 6th. Gloria So of Reuters has more.
Speaking on the House floor, she doubled down on calls for Republican politicians, including her own colleagues, to be held accountable for the attack.
Less than 29 days later, with little to no accountability for the bloodshed and trauma of the 6th, some are already demanding that we move on, or worse, attempting to minimize, discredit, or belittle the accounts of survivors.
Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota said, out of fear for their safety that day, he had screamed to his colleagues to follow him to the Republican side of the floor.
For I felt that the insurrectionists who were trying to break down the doors right here would spare us if they simply mistook us for Republicans. But within moments, I recognized that blending in was not an option available to my colleagues of color. So I'm here tonight to say to my brothers and sisters in Congress and all around our country. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. For I had never understood, really understood, what privilege really means.
Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, who is a Muslim, recounted how the riots reminded her of death threats she received on her very first day as a congresswoman.
I didn't even get sworn in yet, and someone wanted me dead for just existing. More came later, uglier, more violent. One celebrating and writing the New Zealand massacre and hoping that more would come. Another mentioning my dear son, Adam. And so I urge my colleagues to please, please take what happened on January 6th seriously. It will lead to more death, and we can do better. We must do better.
No Republicans participated in Thursday's testimonies, which came shortly after the House voted to remove controversial lawmaker Marjorie Taylor Greene from two high-profile committees. Greene, a Republican, has come under fire for her history of inflammatory remarks, including supporting violence against Democrats.
That was Gloria So of Reuters. U.S. lawmakers say the threat of domestic extremism remains high almost 1 month after pro-Trump protesters violently stormed the U.S. Capitol, resulting in the deaths of five people. As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, those threats are expected to continue well past the Senate's impeachment trial of former President Trump.
The consequences of the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol still playing out this week. As the U.S. Capitol police officer killed in the assault is honored, and the U.S. Senate prepares for next week's impeachment trial, weighing whether former President Donald Trump incited an insurrection over his baseless election claims.
You'll never take back our country with weakness.
But extremism stems from more than anger over the 2020 presidential election, lawmakers warned Thursday. House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Bernie Thompson.
The irrefutable fact is that the threat of right-wing and more specifically white nationalist terrorism has been growing for years. The previous administration failed to address this threat appropriately.
More than 160 people nationwide have been charged for their role in the riot, with hundreds more arrests expected. The Department of Homeland Security issuing a rare threat warning on domestic extremism, a growth in white nationalism, and a belief in conspiracy theories that can be manipulated by foreign adversaries, analysts warned. D.C. Homeland Security and Emergency Management Agency Director Christopher Rodriguez.
Russia in particular are employing decades-old tools of covert action to fan the flames of cultural conflict here in the U.S. And our foreign enemies do this by creating or perpetuating false narratives that strike at the heart of democracy itself, that our elections are rigged, that our system is inherently corrupt and should be overthrown, and that radical voices who call for violence or insurrection have legitimate views.
The assault on the Capitol, planned in part on platforms such as Facebook and Parler, also renewing debate over the need to set tougher standards for social media. Former Assistant Homeland Security Secretary for Counterterrorism, Elizabeth Newman.
Extremist ideas have been mainstreamed and normalized through political speech, conspiracy theories, and communications that use humor and memes to mask the danger of those ideas present. Consequently, there is a high likelihood of violence in the coming months on a range of softer targets. I do believe that we will be fighting domestic terrorism that has its roots and inspiration points from January 6th for the next 10 to 20 years.
But left-wing extremists should also be considered part of the domestic threat, some House Republicans argue. Republican Representative Jeff Van Drew.
Whether it's left-wing extremism, such as what we saw in Portland, Seattle, Kenosha, and even here in D.C., or right-wing extremism, as what occurred at the Capitol on January 6th, it is a serious issue, and it must be remedied.
National Guard troops are expected to be in the nation's capital through the impeachment trial and beyond to guard against continuing domestic threats. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and today's editor, Paul Alexander, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great weekend.